21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. My shoes are worn out. I'm walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feelings as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus hanging out here. I'm a lowly PhD hanging out here in my little studio. And our executive producer, research assistant Laura Cordner, our engineer is Anna Caroline Caruso. That's what it says up there. It's Noah Dankner. Hey, they changed. Oh, my goodness. They must have fired Anna Caroline. Well, they didn't, obviously. Oh, boy. Time out here on a playing field. You ready? Up and at 'em. All right. Did Scotland and the Knights Templar influence the founding of America and the design of America's Great Seal? Well, the official version of who designed and executed America's Great Seal has been that three committees submitted designs, and ultimately the final designs were arranged by Charles Thompson and William Barton. Their designs were officially approved by the Congress on June 20th, 1782. Now, I've always accepted that conclusion. I didn't at first, but then I was talked into it, and it seemed pretty reasonable to me at the time. But Gary Gianetti has been working for years to document that Robert Scott, the engraver of the first die, was the actual man in charge of the final design. Gianetti presents his genealogical research that raises questions about how the Scott family is directly associated by marriage to families of the Knights Templar. According to his theory, Robert Scott did not come to America to win the respect of the Founding Fathers in an attempt to get the job of making the United States seals. Instead, Scott was trained and sent to the United States to do the job as part of the secret influence of these families, called the Unknown Superiors. Now, these secret Jacobites, Jacobites, I love that word, it means so many things, exiled from Scotland, and Gianetti asked the crucial question of what role did Scotland and the Templars play in the founding of America and the design of America's Great Seal, where Gary Gianetti was born on the property of a Revolutionary War sea captain. And he's had an interest in both colonial history and the sea ever since. Exposed to the maritime industries from a young age with his father, a pioneer maritime electronics engineer, Gary became a licensed merchant marine right out of high school. He has worked in the yachting industries, traveling from Maine to Florida and the West Indies, where he took advantage of searching the libraries, museums, and archives all over the Eastern Seaboard to further his study of colonial history. He achieved his Merchant Master's License, or Captain's Papers, but following a near-death experience in 2004, he hung up his sea bag and married his high school sweetheart. And today, he enjoys solving historical and genealogical mysteries while working as a subcontractor with the house and property maintenance. His goal is to contribute to society through restoring the lost origins of the national coat of arms and who was behind the true founding of America. Welcome to 21st Century Radio again. How you doing there, Gary?
Doing well, Bob. How are you?
I'm about a B+.
Yeah, I'm about a C today, this weather and cold.
Well, yeah, but we're a little bit better off here for you down here, but we're getting a big cold tomorrow, so we'll get even with everybody else then. Now, Gary, tell us about the Scott Atchison. Is it Atchison? How you pronounce it?
Atchison.
Atchison family royal mint connections. And tell us a little bit about Scott's life.
Okay. What we have is a bunch of high-ranking royal families, which Scott comes from. And there's a line of family where it breaks off, the Sinclairs, who control the guilds are the Grand Masters of Freemasonry. And the Atchinsons are a mystery to many people. And by the late 1600s, you have a branch of this family that has this name where they hold a title called the Lord of Gosford. And this man's a director of chancery, just like Robert Scott's great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And that means he's the head of the courts and the law for Ireland, and Robert Scott's great-great-grandfather, Sir John, is the head of the government courts for Scotland. Mm-hmm. So this mystery was that when I did this research on this mystery of this whole family of Atchinsons, there were families trying to get approval and an apology from the Pope a couple years ago about Templar families being burned at the stake back in the day. And this was a big controversial bit of history. And I focused on studying this. I became friends with one of the descendants here in the States that's done some work, but there hadn't been a great deal of work in genealogy with these families, more so on the side of trying to prove who they were. No one really knows. And there's one branch of an ancient line that holds the name, and then there's another branch that took the name from Gosford and had these high-ranking titles. And with my research, I started doing some work where I found out a line called the Coburn or Cockburn line, same with the rooster symbolism, mm-hmm. Kind of. But what you have is that there was two Sinclair branches, one of the Roslyn line and Caithness lines, and then you had one that broke off that was called the Herdmanston lines. And all very, very important and powerful families married to some of the most important royal bloodlines at the highest levels, going right back to the direct families with connecting the whole history of Ground Zero, Kilwinning Abbey, and to the ancient kings of Scotland and Ireland and England, the whole mix. And so there was this Atchinson, a man that was the Robert Scott's great-grandfather married the daughter. Sir John marries this Atchinson, and I wanted to figure out who she was. And there were some documents out there found that through some genealogy people that Atchinson had changed his name, and he was a St. Clair. So you're saying it's a Sinclair St. Clair of Herdmanston. And he actually had killed another man over a land dispute of land given to him from his mother. And it wound up being that this Atchinson is the St. Clair to the lines, or sorry, St. Clairs of Herdmanston. And with further research, I wound up learning that this was the line given these titles, that they were also directly connected to a place called Salt Preston, and or Preston just outside of Scotland, 10, 15, 20 miles. And it's a famous harbor. And this was a harbor that was run by Cistercian monks. And it was titled over to this family of the St. Clair Alexander, who changed his name. And supposedly, the documents are showing that some say that the son is not, but some say he is. But when you see the titles, there's just no way you can say it's not true. And where they had run this harbor and controlled even guilds, and they established a Masonic lodge, which happens to be the records of the oldest lodge of Freemasonry in the world that are surviving come from that lodge specifically. And this links in a lot of important families, and Setons and royal families and Stuarts and all their connections, because the Stuarts gave them the rights to having this property. And so branches of these families with the same name with a mix of other Atchinsons wound up being the governors of the Royal Mint, and also the chief coiners, and some of them moving to Edinburgh within close proximity and being associated over a couple 150 years with the Scott family. And it's just an amazing thing. And so it's really a control of their position with having this gilded right. It's a right through these guilds of these families, allowing them to do what they were doing. And you should see some of these coins that they've made. There was a commemorative made that if you were to take one of the coins that Robert Scott made when he was at the U.S. Mint from the 1790s and the hair flow and the actual cutting styles, mm-hmm. it's identical of Queen Mary of Guise. And it's just amazing. So a lot of this older history of this art design was passed down. It had to come through him because he's the one that did the sinking of the coins at the U.S. Mint. And so basically they were a tight-knit family, very close with the Atchinsons in Edinburgh and some of the houses that were built for a long period of time. And there were a lot of feuds amongst these families. There was a lot of killing and special documents that were written by the higher lords of the families that when these families were feuding amongst themselves for whatever it was, basically over this land for a long period of time, they wound up having these like cease and desist orders that certain families, certain members cannot assault this one son or this cousin or a relative. So it's still pretty amazing and a mystery. And so the one line that then becomes this high-ranking Lord of Chancery, the Lord of Gosford, he was actually the first Baron of Nova Scotia, one of them. And there's a whole bunch of Barons in Nova Scotia. But when you're talking about St. Clairs and Sinclairs, what do you link with Nova Scotia? You link the history of one of the most mysterious islands in history, which is Oak Island, yes, and sir. The whole Templar treasure mystery. Mm-hmm. And you never hear the academics and historians and mainstream people ever talking about who was running the show from the 1600s all the way through into the 1800s. And when you look at it, who were these barons and people were that held these titles, they were all Scottish, and they're all connected to these direct families. So it's an amazing thing to reconnect and to see that here they are connected to a direct relative to the oldest, most likely, definitely they're directly related, and to the oldest lodge with documents existing in the world.
What is the oldest lodge, Gary?
It's actually called the Atchison Lodge.
The Atchison Lodge, of course.
Atchison's Lodge in mm-hmm. Preston, Panzer Salt, Preston's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 1580, these records.
About 1580.
Scott
actually had a lifelong job at the Mint. How did that come about?
There were written documents stating that Washington and Jefferson had allowed him the opportunity to work at the Mint, and he was allowed. Now think about this. If you're a hired worker for the government, he was allowed to do side contracts of whatever he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen anywhere else. Think about it. How could you have a job working for the government full-time as the head engraver or sinker of the coins and be able to have a money company, an international banking money company that's massive, one of the biggest in the world that it grew to in the 1800s? He was doing numerous medals and commemorative medals and portrait engravings and paintings and flags. He had done so many other things on the side. And when you look at him having this opportunity, taking the opportunity and doing that, he had to have a lot of pull.
Yeah,
to be able to just do what he wanted.
Yeah.
With permission of the president.
Well, he was part of the family.
Part of the family,
and
yeah.
That really makes a heck of a difference. You know, and as you note, he not only made, was involved, well, the theory is, and to me it seems credible, very credible. A lot of people are going to be upset about, you know, Gary, a lot of people are going to be upset by this. I mean, not necessarily our listeners out there, but those who are historians, this is going to get them, they're a little blindsided on this one. I don't think they've even thought that this was even possible.
It was possible because if you look at who the ruling families were since the 1300s, this line of family with the Stuarts and a whole bunch of other high-ranking royal families, these are the ruling families of where our sovereignty comes from to begin with.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's what people got to connect the dots with. It's pretty basic to understand.
That he also did currencies around the world.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct. He did. The American Banknote Company.
The American Banknote Company. And this was, of course, I think this, you can then from there easily explain as to why he is not known or did not want to be known. Why? What was the reason? Why was he hiding?
Well, the main thing that I understand now is that when I had spent some time ago, I told you I had some help from a lodge historian in the research of trying to identify his family, who his father and line of family were. It was very hard to do. And having the support of the historian at a lodge in Scotland today called the Canongate Scott Lodge, the historian there, thank God, as a blessing that, you know, being a person that's an American, you just don't always have doors opening for you, more closed for you from people from overseas, you know, looking at you as an American, especially me with my last name being Giannotti. You know, I don't exactly have an Irish last name, you know, but it was tough. So he actually helped me out, and he wanted to know about his founding master, George Scott, that no one could even identify even today who the heck he was in the 1745, 2 days before the last Scottish Jacobite uprising to try to have an attempt to take back the throne for the exiled families, the ruling families.
What were the dates on that? When did that start?
1745.
Well, with 1745, we're going to take a break here. And we will return with our guest, Gary Giannotti. We're looking at his genealogical research, questioning whether Scotland and the Knights Templar influenced the founding of America and the design of America's Great Seal. Check out your growing YouTube channel at youtube.com/21st century radio.
I'm Joe Sobrin, author of Alias Shakespeare. You're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
Ah, brother Joe Sobrin has passed on, but he did some amazing work on who do you think really wrote Shakespeare? Boy, you'd be surprised. But we're not going to get into that, because tonight we're talking with Gary Giannotti. And we are talking about the possibility that those who designed our coats of arms were not necessarily the people we were told was designing them. And we're talking especially about Robert Scott at this time, who not only worked on those kind of the images and symbols of our nation, but also they created and designed money, such as a matter of fact, they did actually designed, along with Hopkinson, our $50 bill. Is that correct, sir?
I believe he did. Scott had done some work with Hall and Sellers, and those were the two famous banknote continental money makers.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that there's documentation of him actually working with them. And I'm working on trying to recover this very rare book and the information from it that may list him doing some of these notes.
Oh,
but he may not be listed, but we do know he is, absolutely. And one of the big ones that allows me to know that Scott did that $50 note is the recent discovery of a flag that I'm trying to work on that's at the Grand Lodge in Pennsylvania. And it's an eagle, a very rare eagle flag. It's very, very important flag, and it's flawlessly identical to his 1795 silver dollars, and, I mean, identical in the body designs and the wings. It's just unmistakable, but there's these arrows on there and the patterns and the styles that he does with these big, broad-headed arrows that he painted. They're just identical to what you see on the back of the banknotes, and at the same time, when you look close at these notes, all of these artists often in multiple places with their students or with their close associates that were engravers with them. They had usually several people or a couple people worked on each note or coins together. And so they often left multiple maker's marks on the original notes or on the coins themselves.
Now, that's super important, right,
yes.
That you mentioned there, because, friends, if you go to our website and you see our front page, you'll see this. All government and royal church seals have an art within the art. Now, this is something Gary has introduced me to, a lot of important stuff, friends, and this especially is. Tell us a little bit about what this means, art within art, especially with the great seal or the flag or whatever symbol.
Okay. These artists were able to do, when they did this art, the real fine, small art in coins or in engravings, they used piercing needles. And they did use lenses where that they could actually see into the thousands, very microscopic that the eye can't see. So what you'll see is, an example is, on Bob's site, you'll see a button, and it's got eight points for a star. And you'll see that on some of these points, you'll see these very large letters and symbols, like there are S's on there that are maker's marks. We know that to be certain because they match up specifically to certain artists, such as Pierre-Eugène de Simitier worked on this button, and it's never been known before, especially when you see the shank of it and you match this up to the seals that they worked on or their original prints, like he did Charles Thompson's engraving, and you'll see the maker's mark. It's huge. The whole hair set of his head has that. So you'll see these maker's marks. But then throughout the whole area, you'll see these symbols that are ancient symbols that are throughout the entire relief and non-relief flat parts, symbols that they valued that go back thousands of years. And what the heck some of them are, I still can't even figure them out, but they're there. And what makes it even better for you to be able to see this now is that these specific flags that I've been working on, one that I have proven that was General Arthur St. Clair, mm-hmm. who was President of Congress, very famous and important man, and having identified his flag, you can now see a couple of these ones that I found and actually see these. They're 5-6 feet. So when you get up and see these things painted, you can easily pick it out. Where, like this one that I'm studying with the eagle, you'll see that in the each feather will have all kinds of written symbols. Mm-hmm. And then there's, I mean, just hundreds upon hundreds of weird three-dimensional odd symbols. And they also pressed the textiles with symbols. So it's just made up of just ancient symbols of what they valued going back to ancient times with meaning. And I see a lot of this style of art carried through all the way back into the past in what you see in Celtic stones. So a lot of that ancient stone art does have this, and Celtic metal art, and going all the way back to seeing who when the Scottish had their Declaration of Independence in the early 1300s, they make mention of the people that they come from, and they believe, they say that we were descended from the Scythians, which are a race of people that were some of the lost tribes from the Middle East. And you can still see their metal gold work, these massive gold pieces that are in museums all over the world, from Russia to who knows where. Just they're out there if you just Google. And you look at these things close, and if you see a picture of a face, a portrait, a gold face, you will see, or something that has wings on it that looks like one of those birds with the eagle heads, right? One of those lions with the eagle heads. Mm-hmm. You'll see that everywhere on the surfaces that they were practicing the art going back to 2,000 plus years ago. And you'll see this even on some of the gold masks, the Egyptian masks. And I've got some great images of where they did this type of stipple artwork that goes back to ancient Egypt.
How did you learn this? How did you learn this? This is a really important insight, in especially with artists when they did these creations. I had heard suggestions about 20 or 30 years ago that might happen, But you were the person that introduced me that this was a fact. This is not just theory.
Well, this isn't. All right. Every major cathedral in Europe, every major stone artwork, you go, especially at Roslyn, the famous Notre Dame in France, and there's a few others. There's tons of them. When you start studying the stone artwork, you will see this in all the stone artwork as well.
Mm-hmm.
And people are blind to this. It's insane. And some places have higher quality, finer art. And so when you see them on this bigger stone art, they're much bigger. So it's not like it's being hidden. And you'll see this on, like, the Newport Tower. I found a lot of this hidden artwork in there that all the top academics overlooked, and I photographed it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had it confirmed with associates of mine that know this symbolism. And
let me get into an area that I know some of our listeners are very much interested in, because you have, again, pointed out some very important things dealing with, what would you say, Freemasonry. In Freemasonry, one of the things that there are two parts of the Sinclair family.
Yep.
And we actually have part of that Sinclair family that lives in Maryland. I don't know how they're directly related to that particular family, but they...
Oh, yeah. I studied them. I know who they all are. They're awesome history, awesome family of other high-ranking officers in the U.S. Navy in the early 1800s.
So would you tell us the difference between, the differences between those two families? It's not just the name, but it's also what they were about, especially in regards to Freemasonry.
Okay. You had an original descendant, and I'm lucky. I have a good friend of mine, Robert St. Clair, who's one of the very few people in America, and he's from Canada. And he's a dedicated researcher to the Sinclair family, Sinclair family. And there's right now, amongst all these families, this clan, they still have clans and websites. They still fight. The American Sinclair families won't even allow my documents to even go up on the websites that promotes their 501c3 education and promoting the lost history of their families. It's like... it's crazy.
Why wouldn't they do that?
A lot of it's ignorance. A lot of them aren't even proven true families, controlling other family members that are actually proven families mm-hmm. with DNA. And I've seen all that. And, you know, these hardships of what people are doing, not just with in the history world, but also in the family and genealogical world. There's just, it's tough. People just fight, want to control information. And there's a big problem there with the whole Sinclair families. And the one thing I do know is the one person that I'm dear friends with, this Robert St. Clair that I speak to all the time, he's a proven Caithness to Roslyn, proven DNA, and documented descendant. And there's very few people in America that can prove that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so back in the oldest times, you have this one St. Clair, Day Clair, that came over, and it's supposed to be a maternal grandson of Richard of Normandy. Okay, this is the Duke of Normandy,
mm-hmm.
and his son is actually Day Clair, famous, another famous Lord of England later. And so these families break up, and there's always still controversies with who, when they're trying to push and prove who the true family is back to France, this lost identity, the farthest times back to like the 900s, the year 1050. And so you have one branch that's known to have, as everyone sees, breaks off to a St. Clair line of Herdmanston, and another one breaks off with the Roslyn and Caithness lines. There's a couple branches. And then they more break off from there. But those are really the two main arteries. And there hasn't been really anyone prove. I've heard one person was. I have not heard if they even matched up to Robert and these other family members back overseas yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still a head-butting game going on amongst their own. and outsiders too, especially, you know, I'm an outsider with some.
Yeah.
But what you have is that this family winds up coming over and they're intermarried with the highest ranking royal families, bloodlines of the kings, the ancient kings, along with the Stuart family. So you have a bunch of Normans that come over with William the Conqueror, and then they wind up becoming the ruling families as maternal grandchildren that wind up taking over the throne when the Stuarts took power. So prior to that, there were the ancient kings that were the ancient lines of these, the Irish Dalrida, the kings of Alba, and Iona, a whole mix of the ancient kings, the Pictish people mix, the Celts, these ancient Celts. And so that history winds up kind of dying off. And you remember when I mentioned that. Let me just step back here for a second, because this is important when you start learning how the Sinclairs were given their title as Grandmasters. And these ancient lines of kings with King Duncan, who these lines are the bloodlines to the Thane. And that is the Crinan the Thane and his wife. He got his high powers from his maternal line to the MacAlpins and the ancient kings of Alba and Iona and Ireland and Scotland and England. So you have the family wind up breaking off. One branch goes towards the Roslin lines, and then the other one is Herdmanston. And the Roslin line, when the Stuarts took over, they're intermarried with a whole bunch of multiple families of these royal lines. And when the Stuarts came into power, being the kings, they granted them this hereditary right, bloodline right, as grandmasters. And it was under the his advisor, the king's advisor, who was also supposed to be one of the highest-ranking masons at the time, the Master of Works. And that mason's name was Shaw.
Lord Shaw?
William Shaw, Sir William Shaw. So the Master of Works was responsible for all the palaces and building and everything. So he was highly skilled in mathematics and stone masonry, having people serving under him. But he was also a part of the king's household, royal household. And Shaw is the one under his word that granted him that right. So the Shaws are a part of the MacIntosh lines that go all the way back to being those early ancient kings that I was telling you about, where they got their powers from, the true kings of Scotland and Ireland and England, the Dalrida, from the kings of Alba and Iona and all that. So Shaw is actually, the name changes, but they're actually a bloodline to the Thane. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're a direct male bloodline. And if you know about the American flag, I worked on the Shaw flag. This has opened up all doors to being the most valuable stars and stripes in American history now, because of that relationship of them being so secret, all the Shaws, because they were in a high-ranking secret Masonic family. Not only were they high-ranking royal bloodlines. So they're granted this hereditary right, and then some hundreds of years, 1700s later on, they wind up one of the Sinclairs of Roslin loses his title, or gives up his title, so that Grand Lodges, other lodges, can be formed with other Grand Masters. And so he had it for a year. But the Stuart King was already exiled, so he wound up never having taken away those charters. So they're granted charters by the king under the advisory of Lord Shaw.
Time out. Time out on the playing field with Lord Shaw, because we're headed towards trying to understand, I'm trying to understand especially, the division of the Sinclair family and what they believe and how they're involved with which element of Freemasonry, with our guest, Gary Gianetti. And again, we're looking at his genealogical research, questioning whether Scotland and the Knights Templar influenced the founding of America and the design of America's Great Seal.
This is Mitch Horowitz, the author of Occult America, and you are listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio. This is the place to be for information about everything you love in the world of esoterica, the occult, and alternative spirituality.
Now, thank you. And, of course, what song was that? That sounds like Little Richard. Is that Little Richard? It's the Beatles. Of course. Well, I'm getting old, friends. Okay, with our guest, Gary Giannotti. Gary, which of these two Sinclairs, which are adhere to the Scottish Rite, and which are linked to Robert Scott?
The Scottish Rite is, you're saying Scottish Rite, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, the Scottish Rite was created after the 1800s, so it has nothing to do with these families and the origins of Freemasonry, except of the charters from France that is where it was established, that associate the Stuarts. So you have the Sinclairs married and related to them. The order of, let me not get into the order. Well, you have them all intermarried with the Stuarts, the Douglas lines, which are the Flemings. The Scots are Flemings. And so it's this intermarriage to the direct royal families, pretty much, that is a part of this whole origin connected to the families for Freemasonry. And a lot of them, like, for instance, I told you in the past, there was a lot of that ancient side of... it was a lot of the ancient side of the family from their Norman side. And a lot of the Norman side of these lines are intermarried to the kings of Jerusalem. And the kings of Jerusalem are the ones that granted all the creation of the Templars. So they're intermarried into them multiple times over.
So from your perspective, and it's from Scotland's perspective, there is the possibility... Not possibility, but one is, as you said, wasn't created until the 18th century. Now, that, 18th century, isn't that long ago?
Freemasonry?
Yes.
Well, the Freemasonry that people see today.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, but, and this is important because...
18th century with the guilds, you know, mainly the guilds, and that's what the Sinclairs controlled in a lot of these families.
Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, when you take a look at those who get involved with, because we're not going to have time to get into all the wonderful esoteric stuff that is comes along with Robert Scott and his knowledge there, because of all the other material you've given me that I've read, it seems that there is a real depth within his research and others that is more along the lines of the free. Well, I'm a co-mason, and we work with both men and women in the lodges, which is not the usual thing at all, except that I found that the elderly women, especially those that are in their 75s and 90s, really know those rituals inside and out, and you really feel what's going on. So that's why I love being with the ladies there. But there is a problem that you've had with be the Scottish Rite. And there's so many Scots and Scottish Rites here, I'm getting the little things mixed up here. But that is really important because I think those that get involved in secret societies and esoterica and the ageless wisdom teachings is what I'm really trying to say here, look at all of the rituals in a totally different way than those who are not involved in the esoteric side of it. Do you think that's fair to say?
Sure.
And it's a big difference.
Sure.
Because there's meaning and purpose in what's going on, especially when you get into the more esoteric aspects of it. And what you have done also, because we're going to run out of time before we get to a lot of other things. So I'm going to move into this other area of the symbols on the Great Seal of the United States that especially are esoteric from and that lead into the work of Robert Scott and others along these lines, such as when you take the unfinished pyramid. And you and the other symbols within it, when you get to say for instance obelisks and that type of thing.
Yeah.
Now, that's where you and I have bonded in trying to understand what these symbols are really all about. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Especially when you've pulled out information dealing with the all-seeing eye that I've never seen before. Would you like to mention that, please?
Would it be the one on the button that we had talked about in the past?
Well, it's not just the button, but it's like the ceiling panels that were done.
Oh, sure. Sure,
et cetera, which most people are not aware of because as soon as they hear about the eye in the triangle, they only think that it is just something that is not, cannot be corroborated as going back into the higher dimensions, because that's what I like about the esoteric aspects. It's it's a very different dimension that you're dealing with here.
Correct.
One that has more permanency, let me put it that way, along those lines. So that's the reason why, especially let's take the Eagle Phoenix, because this has been a great puzzle. There's been a lot of puzzles on the Great Seal to me. And one of them was when I started looking at this in 1967, 68, and I looked at it and said, look at these symbols. They must come from some esoteric society or something. They must come from, there's a higher meaning here. So what is it? Of course, I went to the State Department. They told me, no, Bob, that's not going on there. There may have been Freemasons involved, but not many, and so therefore it's not that important. But I'd learned later on that that was important, especially in regards to, say, for instance, the phoenix. What is the phoenix in comparison to the eagle?
Well, what you will see is that there was a whole series of great seals made for the presidents. There was four or five made, and there's two surviving in Washington at the archives, one from the old collection when I was at the National Museum, which is the oldest Great Seal that can be confirmed, which is the second Great Seal. So that one had a different, they made it look like a rooster, the cock of the head or the comb of a cock, rooster. And, you know, the ancient rooster symbolism going all the way back to the ancients with the symbolism of Abraxas, that's how you pronounce
Abraxas,
them properly.
Yeah,
The meaning with the light.
Yeah.
So that's a symbol in association with that. And you remember when I told you about the St. Clairs of Hurdmanston? The St. Clairs of Hurdmanston and the St. Clairs do have in their coat of arms a rooster on top of their arms.
Yeah.
And then I was studying a site where one of the castles, they were showing this ceiling panel. And the ceiling panel is like 5 feet. And it's all wood, and it's flush-mounted to fit in this big dining room. And you see the arms where you see a mermaid, and then you see this griffin bird. You see the grailed cross and the shield. But then above that, you see the helmet. And then with the helmet, it's oval, though. It's an oval cage of the faceplate. And I'm studying this thing, and I become so familiar with turning all the objects that I study. I turn them on all different angles, my photographs. And having studied this, I've become aware of how these guys were doing art, three-dimensional. So basically, you take this image aside, and it looks like two pieces of ribbon, and it winds up spreading out identical to what we see on an all-seeing eye flag that's known to exist. And then you see the rooster, and then you look at the helmet, and it winds up becoming an all-seeing eye.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if people are going to sit there and say, "Oh, is this was made in 1580, and is this an all-seeing eye?" Oh, it definitely is. And people have to remember too that you don't hear much of many people saying that in the ancient churches, all the churches in Europe with the Catholic Church in Spain and France, There are a lot of churches that have the all-seeing eye. That was a part of their normal history.
That's right.
And that's been forgotten.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So they are a holy family, yes. Why are they holy? Because they got royal bloodlines, and many of these families have multiple bishops in their family lines too. So in essence, they are a holy bloodline just from their marriages and their children that were important bishops over hundreds of years. A whole slew of them. So that was an interesting and a very important find that blew away people's mind, because some of these family members, they never could even imagine seeing that. But with the rooster, it represents the light, the beams of the light, and that history. It's one of the most ancient symbols of, you know, warding off good and evils going all the way back to Persia. And this was found in their arms. And so we found the first all-seeing eye represented in a Sinclair coat of arms.
And also, when you get to the Great Pyramid, the unfinished pyramid, I remember when the first time I saw this on the first designs, they were tall, thin. The very first one, right, was a tall and thin pyramid.
Correct, yeah.
And I said to myself, hey, wait a second. That's not the one that's on the back of the $1 bill. So how did it get like this? Well, there wasn't any answer to that. But there is an answer.
Yeah, we figured this one out, and it's been known, but it's been known and then forgotten.
That's correct.
And I'm very fortunate here, because my very dear close research friend of mine is a gentleman named Bradbury Court Lindau. And people want to read this on this whole history. It's on survivalcell.blogspot. And if you Google my name and Court Lindau and the Kirkwall Scroll, this was a scroll, the most sacred.
Let's talk about that when we return, because we're at the very top of the hour. This Kirkwall Scroll, which I checked into today, thanks to your sending me an email on that last night. And that's really important. Then we can also talk about the Nubian pyramids, which are really important in comparison to this. We'll be back with our guest, Gary Gianetti, and we're looking at his genealogical research. Did Scotland have anything to do with America's Great Seal? Were they involved in the founding of this country?
Stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lucero. The Department of